This podcast is brought to you by A. Miller George Funeral Home, where each life is celebrated, and their sister company, Cremation London Middlesex, both family-owned and operated. By the Diocese of Huron, a community where families and individuals from Windsor to Owen Sound, Grand Bend to Port Rowan, come together to worship and serve. And by Molly Maid. Make your home a healthy haven. Call Molly Maid London today. On this episode, we welcome Patty Krawek. Patty is an Anishinaabe and Ukrainian writer from Lake Soul First Nation and the co-host of the Medicine for the Resistance podcast. We'll discuss her recent book, Becoming Kin, an Indigenous call to unforgetting the past and reimagining our future. Her book is a remarkable sojourn through Native and settler history, myth, identity, and spirituality that helps us retrace our steps and pick up what was lost along the way. Chances to honor rather than violate treaties, to see the land as a relative rather than a resource, and to unravel the history we have been taught.
Well, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever and whenever you may be listening. We welcome you back to another edition of the Vicar's Crossing podcast. The Vicar's Crossing is a virtual space where faith intersects with the public square. My name is Rob Henderson, and I serve as the priest at Holy Trinity St. Stephen's Anglican Church in London, Ontario.
Yeah, better guy you won't find. I'm just going to say that right now. Better guy you won't find than that, Rob Henderson. I'm Kevin George. You can find a lot better than me just about anywhere. I hang out at St. Aidan's Anglican Church in the northwest corner of London, Ontario. And I'm a big fan of introducing yourself at the beginning of a podcast.
Me too.
I like
that's
that.
That's right. Yeah. That's Broadcasting 101. Tell them who you are.
Tell them who you are.
Well, I'm glad we're back, Kevin. It's good to see you, my friend. Ian is off today, a little under the weather, but we hope to see him back on the podcast. Has he got the scurvy again?
Typhoid, young man. Maybe it's beriberi, as I don't know.
Could be that, too. But we are glad we're back with you. We got a wonderful episode today, and a guest. I'll call her a neighbor. She's just down the road in Niagara Falls. So
That's right. We didn't
have to search too far.
No.
Welcome to the sixth episode of season 8 of the podcast. Today, we're excited to welcome to the podcast Patty Krawek. And Patty is an Anishinaabe and Ukrainian writer from Lac Seul First Nation. And she is a member of the Presbyterian Church. And she lives, as I said, in Niagara Falls. And the book we're going to be talking about is her work. It's called Becoming Kin, an Indigenous call to unforgetting the past and reimagining the future. There it is.
Yep. Yeah, it's a great book too. And this is one of those books that I think our churches could do well to include in a study. So much more to come on that. With that in mind, we want to, as we always do here, a land acknowledgement. The Vicar's Crossing acknowledges that our podcast is recorded on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Haudenosaunee, Lenape, and Attawandaran peoples on lands connected with the London Township and Somber Treaties and the Dish with One Spoon Covenant Wampum. This land continues to be home to diverse Indigenous peoples whom we recognize as contemporary stewards of the land. We acknowledge that our presence on this land as colonial settler people has benefited us disproportionately, and we wish to find ways to not just acknowledge that, but consider how we can do better and how we might walk hand in hand with our Indigenous siblings going forward towards reconciliation.
And as always, we want to give a big shout out to our sponsors, without whom we would not be able to do this. Kevin, as you know, if it was just us,
we'd be using
our Radio Shack tape recorder.
That's right.
Grade six.
Remember doing that together. when we used to. Did you ever play radio? I mean, you became a radio
course.
Guy, but,
yeah,
but did you play radio with the tape recorder? You pushed the two things down and your little handheld microphone.
Oh yeah, I used to read the when the cable news came over.
I'd
read it into the machine and practice. That's what I used to do.
Oh yeah, you best Casey Kasem.
I had no friends, so you know, that's what you do on a Saturday night.
this is another thing we have in common.
That's right. Yeah. But no. Thank you to our sponsors who really supported us and been able to help us get this on the air. To A. Miller George Funeral Home, where each life is celebrated, and their sister company, Cremation London Middlesex, both family-owned and operated. And many thanks again to Dave Mullen and everyone at A. Miller George. And we give you a big, big hello from all of us today.
Amen. I wonder if Dave, with his tape recorder, was going, welcome to A. Miller George Funeral Home. so we want to welcome you, and please remember to drive with your headlights on and your four-way splashing. He may have done that as a kid. I don't know.
We'll have to ask him.
Yeah. And we'll have to ask Todd Townsend, who's the bishop of the Diocese of Huron, if he was doing church services into his tape recorder, because his father was a bishop. So maybe he was doing ordinations on his tape recorder. Yeah, but another of our sponsors, of course, is the Diocese of Huron, a community of families and individuals from Windsor to Owen Sound and from Grand Bend to Port Rowan, coming together to worship and serve, a diocese which Rob and I are both proud to be a part of and our communities are. Thank you to Todd Townsend and the Diocese for supporting our work.
And last but certainly not least, to Molly Maid, make your home a healthy haven. Call Molly Maid in London today. Do it right as soon as you're done.
That's
with
right.
This podcast, because you're looking around, you're seeing the dust, you're seeing the mess. You're saying, I don't have time.
I got
to
get it clean.
You're going to call Tricia Listar, and you're going to talk to the folks at Molly Maid and get things taken care of.
Tricia will sweep you off your feet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So thank you to her and all our sponsors today.
Awesome.
And I think Patty's here. So
Patty
enough
is
of
here.
Our nonsense. Let's get talking to Patty about the book and other things from Niagara Falls, Ontario. And here she is. Patty's joining us now in the Vicar's Crossing podcast. Patty, we were saying before we came and brought you in that we're pretty much neighbors because we're in London. You're just down the road in Niagara Falls. So we want to welcome you. And how are things down in Niagara Falls with you today?
Wet and drizzly.
Yeah, it's
not a beautiful sunshiny day today.
No.
Did you get the fog that we had this morning?
I don't think so. I live out in the country, so we often have fog just like normally because there's a pond in our backyard. But
I woke up this morning and I thought I was back in Newfoundland where I grew up. There was fog everywhere.
Yeah, it was pretty thick this morning.
Yeah.
And Patty's not only a neighbor, Kevin, she's not only on our podcast. Patty, you do your own podcast, don't you? Why don't you tell us a bit about that? Its name and where people can find it.
Yeah, so Medicine for the Resistance. Currently on Substack, so medicineforTheResistance.substack.com. Mm-hmm. We've been around for, I think, about four or five years now. My friend Carrie and I, she's Afro-Caribbean and I'm Indigenous and Ojibwe. And so we just kind of talk about all of the things. And we have lots of guests that are interesting and fun. And we have one that is in, I need to get out because we talked about the kinship of olive trees. And that was just so interesting.
Oh, wow. That would be good, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. We had a woman. I found, I find the most interesting people on social media. And I dragged them onto the podcast.
Awesome.
Yeah, I got to get that edited and out there because that was a really good conversation.
Well, we'll do a very public shout out here to Ian, producer Ian. We need editing help for Medicine for the Resistance. Anyway, listen, speaking of being a neighbor, as you say, Rob, and just down the road, we're more than that because Patty makes the case in her book that we're actually kin. We're more than neighbors. We are kin. Your book is incredible, as it is on the wall here. Becoming Kin it's a must-read, I believe. Canadians need to pick up this book and read it. Americans need to pick up this book and read it. It really does call us to some account. Your honest sharing, Patty, of your own life, your own ancestry, and how that has shaped your journey and how you relate to the land, to your family, to your church, to the world. It's all wrapped up in this book. It's just beautiful, and I can't recommend it enough. The book is set in two parts. The first part of the book invites the reader into a deep dive into our shared history. And that, I think, is the part that's really disturbing, appropriately disturbing. I think of the waters being disturbed, and it's like, oh, we really need to hear this. But you mm-hmm. I found myself having to sit with it and found it deeply emotional reading. And then the second half of your book is really about rebuilding relationships and mobilizing those relationships to really create something new, to journey together, in a new way forward. Here's a quote from the book, folks. How do we restore relationships and balance to what has been made so precarious? The promises of the white Christian West have failed to materialize, and we are socially and literally on a precipice. How do we go from living in isolated silos to becoming good relatives? How does the church stop running wild and onshot and put down roots and that reach deeply into the ground? we can draw on everything that our roots have pushed through and around and pull forward, rather than cutting off the roots because we are ashamed or afraid of what we will find. We can learn our history. We can reimagine the relationships we have inherited, and we can take up our responsibilities to each other. I have to say to you, Patty, that that business of not wanting to cut off our roots is really a powerful thread in your book, because I think that for those of us who are descendants of European settlers, those of us who have benefited from stolen lands and everything else that's gone along with that, the temptation, of course, is to just, you know, cut it off and say, oh, ashamed of the history, right? Being kin, you make the point that being kin comes with responsibilities, and it's reciprocal, that a relationship that is has give and take. Talk to us about those responsibilities, about responding in this time of, you describe this time we're in as a time of upheaval, as reimagining rather than an exercise in shame, like reimagining who we might be.
Yeah, so Aurora Levins Morales is a Jewish Puerto Rican historian and poet, and she talks about her own family history in a way that I found really powerful, where she talks about being descended on one side of her family tree from people who owned slaves. And of course, the family myth is then that, you know, oh, well, we were good slave owners. You know, we were kind to the people we bought and sold.
There's a, as and if there's says, a like, good slave owner. I love that. I love that. Good slave owner.
Yeah. You know, and so she said, you know, and she said, like, that's ridiculous. But rather than pretend that her family didn't build wealth in this way, she's like, how transformative is it to think that these slave owners gave birth to an abolitionist? You know, that we can take these ancestries that we have inherited, like, you know, when I think of my own family tree, you know, when I think of my maternal family and finding safety, you know, they were able to come here. You know, they fled first, they fled Stalin's Ukraine for Germany, and then they fled post-war Germany for Canada. And they always had somewhere to flee to. My father's family had nowhere to go, right? Like, where, where are Indigenous people supposed to go? You know, there's only so far north we can go. You know, so part of then my work, as I think about these things that I've inherited, my responsibility, is my work on both sides of my family tree is to reclaim that land. On one sense, to reclaim it, to reclaim the land that knows me. You know, I talk about that experience as well, feeling remembered and known by the land and the waters. But also to make sure that this displacement doesn't happen to other people. Because, of course, colonization, you know, isn't just something that happened when Columbus landed in the Caribbean instead of India. It's this ongoing process that keeps happening and keeps displacing Indigenous people. I mean, our prime minister just bought a pipeline so that he could continue to displace the Wet'suwet'en and move them aside off of their traditional lands so that he could have this pipeline, you know, that benefits some people, but at the expense of others. And so when we're talking about reciprocal relationships, we're also talking about not leaving people behind. About, you know, it's always the same crowd that's benefiting from all of these things. And the rest of us can assimilate into that. But assimilating into that, like, you know, it's that old thing of, oh, you know, if you wanted a better job, you should get a better education. Well, that means that we assume somebody needs to make the coffee and fill our gas tanks. We just don't care how they get paid.
It, and it also runs on the false.
Know, so it's the idea that we can't be leaving people behind.
And it also runs on the false narrative that we all start from the same place, which we don't. Because, you know, some of us have benefited disproportionately. And others have had to start from a different place, right? That notion about just get a better education and, you know, and it's the same way with, and it's this, and we'll talk more about some of these other things, but this constant disappearing of Indigenous peoples, right? This sort of, and I just think that notion that you've pointed out around, taking responsibility and acknowledging the past in a real way without having to live in shame, but to, again, I mean, in the church language, we talk about it in terms of resurrection, of new life, but we can't get there if we're not prepared to look at, you know, there's no Easter without looking squarely into Good Friday. And I think, and there's always a lot of Good Friday in our relationships between settler people and Indigenous people.
it's always amazing to me because I grew up in the church and the relationship has gotten complicated.
I guess.
But but it's always amazing to me that, you know, the church, you know, kind of broadly speaking, which makes its whole thing about confessing your sin,
reconciliation,
and being forgiven, and then transforming your life, can't seem to wrap their heads around, you know, when confronted with the sin of the church.
Yes.
They're like, oh, no, those were bad Christians.
It's a little different.
Those weren't real Christians.
And it's they were well-intended Christians, you know? They meant well.
Oh, yeah. Yes. And you hear that all the time in language, in conversations around residential schools. Yeah. Well, they meant well. Well, they meant well. Yeah. Well, it's no, they did not.
Not at all. I want to talk a bit about disconnection. You know, mentioning you've been in the church and we're church folk too. And one of the things that I don't know how many times I've had to preach on creation stories in the church, but you mentioned those in the book, and you assert that the creation stories that we have, and whether they're Christian creation stories that, you know, I may be most familiar with, or whether they're Hebrew creation stories, there's creation stories from Anishinaabe and Hopi as well. Wherever they're from, they actually aren't meant to be histories. And I think this is something that's really important to point out, and that you point out, not in the sense that, you know, the Western world has invented the idea of history as an unbiased set of facts. They're actually meant, to explain who we are and to create a communal sense of self. We revolve around these centering stories. And in the book, you write about Christians as a people disconnected. Unmoored, a landless people. And maybe that disconnection from land is what has led to other disconnections that are apparent. We've been raised with these disconnected ideas, as you remind us in the book. And again, I just want to offer a quote if I can. And you write, "I remember learning in church that this world was not our home, that we were strangers in a strange land, and that our hope was in heaven." That changes how you look at things. Instead of listening to what the land might have to say for itself, you listen only for what God might be saying through it, reducing it to an empty vessel. It diminishes our investment in the world around us and disconnects us from everything, including people, because we don't listen to them. Relationships become a means to an end, a way to evangelize people so they too can become unmoored and disconnected from everything except Jesus.
Preach.
Patty, can you say more about why this disconnection and this, you know, hunger of churches to evangelize has been so painful?
Wow, I think, yeah, you just said it really well. I mean, I think a lot about the failure of the Christian church to take root in this place. You know, it's needed the authority of the state. It's needed, you know, policies and laws and everything to really kind of make it stick, because of course now that those things have been taken away, now that you no longer socially need to be Christian, although I don't even Trump pretends to be Christian. You know, because it still carries some social currency. But we're watching, you know, denominations are dropping like flies.
Yep.
Because there's no investment in this place. There's no investment in these people. And it's like every generation you have to convert all over again. Because there's no deep connection here. And I think maybe if Christians acted more like guests, I don't know. Christians think of themselves as strangers in a strange land, but then they walk around acting, you know, Willie James Jennings talks about it, you know, they're guests who walk into the house and immediately start acting like autocratic hosts.
Yeah, that's right.
But it's always seen like as a means to an end. This isn't the world that matters. And I've had people say to me, why should we care about climate change?
Yeah.
Why should we care about pollution? Why should we care about this ridiculous half-life, you know, that uranium has, when we're not going to be here forever?
Right.
When this world is not, we've got a new heaven and a new earth that's coming our way.
Yeah, our whole point for existing is to escape.
You've got politicians, and these are people who make laws and policies, saying things like, you know, the real shame when a transgender person dies because of inadequate medical care is the state of their eternal soul. Yeah. No, it's not.
No, it's not.
The real problem is the fact that they died. And maybe you can think about their eternal soul as well. But in the meantime, they need good medical care. In the meantime, people need safe drinking water.
Yes.
And I don't know. The Hopi, the Anishinaabe, all of us, we all have these apocalyptic visions, which makes sense in terms of that's how you deal with scary times, you know, and this vision of a new world, you know, and a place, you know, like the ghost dance, it's this vision of this new world that could be possible. And so we all have these ideas, which is great. But in the meantime, we have to live here. And it's like when we're thinking about abolition, right? Like I'm an abolitionist. That doesn't mean that I'm not also willing to advocate for better conditions for people who are in prison. Because in the meantime, until we abolish prisons, there's still people going to be there and they need to have a good life. And so it's that disconnect that so many people in the church and theology has given them permission to do this, which is kind of why I bang on about it. Because theology isn't inevitable, right? It's just one way to read the text. We could read the story differently. We could come up with something else. But their theology has given them permission to disconnect from people. And I don't know, like I grew up like through the 80s, right? So did you guys go to those friendship evangelism things?
Oh, well, I mean,
Friendship evangelism was like a really big thing, I think, in the, early 80s. Yeah. And now that was like, that was like the thick of my world back then.
Right.
And now I think about that and I'm like, oh my gosh, like
what was
really
I doing?
Thought that way. And people still do.
Yeah.
People really think, let's make friends just for the purpose of evangelizing people.
Right.
And
so that usury,
idea is just so weird to me now. It is, because I belong to a drum group, a hand drum group, and I talk about that in the book as well. And we don't go knocking on doors with our drums, asking people if they've heard the good news of Nana Bougeau, right? just get together every Wednesday and we sing songs and, you know, we have fun. And we're going to be up in Toronto this weekend with Downey Wenjack Fund.
Oh,
and,
nice.
You know, but people come to us. And they want to spend time with us. And our drum group contains non-Indigenous women, you know, and you know, non-Indigenous people. So, and we don't think everybody needs to think like we do.
Right.
But if you're going to be in our circle, then these are kind of the norms. And we're connected to place and to people.
Yes.
I don't know. I'm rambling now.
Well, no, I think that connection that you're talking about, this kinship, really, with land, with one another, you're right. I mean, and you speak of this in the book as well, as you just came to mind as you were saying that, before I jump on to my next question here, is like even how we approach scripture, right? So if we read into the stories, often those of us who are at churches which are full of mainly colonial settler people or descendants of them, we read ourselves into the victim part of the story. Right, not the obnoxious guest. right. So it's like, you know, and I think that
poor beleaguered Israel.
Yes, and
never, you know, Babylon or Rome.
No, we're not Babylon. Oh my goodness, no. And so, you know, I think that a part of the truth telling that some of us have been trying to get to in the church, and I think that this is a part of where this strikes me personally, because I know what I grew up with and I know what I didn't learn and how much, like Rob and I have talked about this a lot. The things we've learned in the last 15 or 20 years here have been incredible. And these last few years, it's an accelerated thing. Mm-hmm. But I've had to unlearn all kinds of toxic, awful things. And I've had to learn and listen and now try and find a way to articulate that on a Sunday morning regularly and use our pulpit, our place to say, let me give you a different interpretation of this story. You know, and I think for the church, if we're going to take reconciliation seriously and we're going to take kinship seriously, then we have to begin to tell reimagine our theological approach to scripture and the stories that we tell when we gather in worship. Would you agree?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and how, like you say, how we see ourselves in this story, because the church always sees itself as, you know, poor benighted Israel because, you know, we're being persecuted this way and that way. And it's like, Christians are not being persecuted in North America.
Can't say Merry Christmas, Patty. You can't say Merry Christmas anywhere.
I know, Starbucks and their war on Christmas.
Let's,
you know, but how powerful would, say, the story of Esther be? Like we just had, it was just Purim. Which I know because I've made an effort on social media to pay attention to Jewish voices.
Yeah.
How powerful would a series on Esther be
Yes.
If the church was in the role of Persia.
Right.
And understood itself to be the Persian, like how would that profoundly shift the story that's being told?
Well,
or, you know, the, what's the other one? The Good Samaritan.
Yes.
Good Samaritan is one that I talk about a lot. Because, of course, the text doesn't call him a Good Samaritan.
No.
He's
we call him a good Samaritan. He's just a Samaritan.
We make him
a dreadful,
one of the
awful
good
person.
Ones.
Yeah.
We make him one of the good ones.
Well, I mean, consider that Holy Week is ahead of us, and you know we're all gonna enter into a deeply emotional space. But you know, rarely do people sitting in European descendant churches want to see themselves as the crucifiers, as the Roman imperial powers, as the ones that Jesus was speaking back against. But anyway, I digress. I want to talk about treaties.
What? Yeah.
Okay. Oh, no. Go ahead. You go ahead. You got something to say?
Well,
about
no.
That.
I was going to continue.
You go ahead.
On the Easter theme.
Go ahead.
Because it's such an anti-Semitic time.
It's horrible.
Right? Because it's always, you know, the Jews killed Jesus. And that's historically, and right up to the modern day, has had some pretty serious consequences. But to hear those stories, as you say, in the context of Roman authority and our willingness to align, you know, Christians' willingness to align with authority and the consequences of that, who dies actually literally.
Right.
Not metaphorically.
No.
You know, or for some greater good.
We don't have to look very far to see this. We're doing it today.
Yeah.
And we've done it for generations since we came here and stole lands. You know, we're unearthing, well, we're not unearthing, but we're so-called discovering graves of children at residential schools that we've been told have been there for decades, but now all of a sudden people believe it. You know, like we've been engaged in this.
And kids still have to leave home to go to school,
yes.
Right? They still have to leave home from their northern communities. They're still going to places like Thunder Bay.
Yes.
And they're still getting murdered.
Yeah.
And they're being found in the river. I mean, Tanya Talaga's book, Seven Feathers, and then now the new podcast, the new documentary, Thunder Bay.
Yeah.
Has been talking about that. So yeah, I mean, these things are still, I guess, not ancient history.
See, this is why, folks, you've got to read this book, because there's so much in there. Like, it's, I'm trying to get on to question two, and I'm still excited about the answer to question one, Rob. So treaties. Let's talk about treaties for a bit. You lay out very well in the book that the indigenous peoples of Turtle Island would resolve disputes with covenants that were encoded in wampum belts. Now, this is language that some people would understand. I mean, many of our churches, mine included, use land acknowledgments, and we talk about this region and the covenant wampum. Now, you describe these as a kind of writing that invites participation. It invites evolution, not a once and done agreement, but a living document, right? Something that has a material expression that may change in order to maintain the principles themselves. Can you say more about the two-row wampum treaties, as well as the dish with one spoon covenant wampum, which we reference a lot in this part of the world, in this part of Turtle Island, or the one dish, one spoon, as it's also known? Because I think sometimes people hear that, but they don't know what it is.
Yeah, so the two-row wampum is it's, and I always get these backwards, it's two purple rows on a white background,
yeah.
I think. Could be the other way around.
I always get them backwards.
Yeah. But that was an agreement made by the Haudenosaunee and the Dutch when it was clear that the Dutch were staying, right? Because I mean, people have been coming and going from these shores for a very long time. I mean, you're from Newfoundland, right? So Lonzo Meadows, like, you know, y'all got Viking stuff all over the place.
Yeah.
But when it was clear that the Dutch were staying, the Haudenosaunee made this agreement with them. And it's basically, so in the one row is the Haudenosaunee way of life. And they're going to continue down this river, living according to their ways. And then on the other boat is the Dutch and their way of life. And they're going to continue. And we're going to continue down this river together, this white background, but not interfering with each other. That principle of non-interference is very strong, you know, around, you know, among indigenous peoples in this area. And the dish with one spoon is very similar in that it was an agreement made between the Anishinaabeg and the Haudenosaunee, that we would live in this place together. And we are two very different people. The Haudenosaunee, you know, they're a confederacy of six nations. They have a longhouse system. They have clan mothers. They have, you know, kind of this, this chieftain thing that goes down. And like, it's a much more, I don't want to say hierarchical, but it's a much, it's a much more structured governance system. Mm-hmm. The Anishinaabe, we have our clans, but we're a bunch of anarchists living in the woods. And I, that just speaks to my heart. Like, it's very clear that I am descended from these people.
And it makes
sense geographically.
Right.
In the ways that our societies evolved. Mm-hmm. And so we were able to live together in this place without interfering with each other, without the Anishinaabe trying to tell the Hodes, wow, are you ever farming, stupid?
Right.
And without the Hodes saying, hey, what are you doing with all that rice?
Right.
You know, we found a way to live together. And that, of course, like when two countries enter into an agreement, we expect that all their allies are going to respect those agreements, right?
Right.
Like the Treaty of Ghent, which set the boundary between Canada and the U.S.
Yes.
We expect France to respect that.
Yes.
Right.
We expect Russia to respect that.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
They were part of that treaty, but we expect them to recognize that that's the border.
Mm-hmm.
So when we entered into these agreements, we expect that our allies will respect these agreements.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as it served the needs of the Dutch and then later the French and English, they did. But as soon as the balance of power shifted, they didn't.
Right. Right.
And what we see now is a whole lot of interference.
Right. And along with that interference, I mean, a lot of it has come from, you write about the Doctrine of Discovery. And again, we'll perhaps get you to clarify on that for those who are not familiar, or I'll offer some of that. For those who are unaware, the Doctrine of Discovery is a legal framework of various papal bulls and secular laws that developed over hundreds of years, beginning in the 12th century. The Doctrine of Discovery established spiritual, legal, and political justification for taking land from those who existed outside of the church's influence. This is what you write about it, and that other peoples with whom Europeans came into contact as well. The Doctrine of Discovery said that lands discovered by European powers belonged to those powers because it wasn't owned by Christians. It is the authority by which the European empires claimed ownership of land that was already occupied by sovereign people, something the United States and Canada recognized in their decisions to make treaties with the indigenous peoples in the first place. That's an acknowledgement of someone's sovereignty, is to make a treaty.
Okay.
This doctrine continues to have implications for indigenous peoples. Can you say more about this doctrine of the discovery and how it remains the basis of contemporary relationship to land, and how Christians might have been better to pursue an alternate road with which we should have been familiar? And you cite Leviticus 25 as a way, a different way, a model. Again, like we were saying earlier, you think the church would lean on the models it has before us. And Leviticus 25 is another way, other than having to issue a bull that says, oh, if it's not Christian, it's ours, we'll just take it.
Yeah, because that's not at all how the Hebrews entered the Promised Land.
No.
So this Doctrine of Discovery, it's not like a single thing. People often talk about it as if it's kind of this single thing that was that came out in the 1500s.
Yeah.
But it's several hundred years of legal principles that have come up, because the church at that time was also the seat of governance and laws and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So they basically said, if Christians aren't living there, then whoever, basically finders keepers. But it was the state that owned it, because this is also the time that states are emerging. So it's not like you, Kevin and Rob, you could go out and just kind of plant your flag and say, well, this is mine now.
Yeah,
You would do that as representatives of the British crown or the Dutch crown or whoever it was. You'd say, okay, this is now Dutch land. And then the crown would get to decide how they want to sell it or give it away or any of those things. And that also applied to people. That's what also laid the basis for the transatlantic slave trade, because they weren't Christians, although some of them were. Because the Ethiopian church was a thing.
That's right. long ago. Yep.
It's a long established thing. But that laid the principles for ownership for Canada and the U.S. And so in Canada, that still gets cited in legal precedent in terms of, you know, we have some underlying title that but it doesn't really belong to us. We don't really have any rights associated with it. In the US, it actually got cited. There was the Marshall Trilogy in the early 1800s, that some of it had to do with missionaries wanting to operate on land, and others of it had to do with the removals. But then Ruth Bader Ginsburg, everybody's, you know, favorite.
Everybody loves her.
Everybody loves Ruthie. She cited these Marshall trilogies in the context of the doctrine of discovery to deny an Oneida land claim. The Oneida had purchased some land, and they wanted to turn it into reserve property so that it couldn't be bought and sold. It would be theirs. And she said, you can't do it. It's not yours. And this is why.
I think you said in the book, 2005?
2005, yeah. You know, she apparently regretted that decision. She apparently said later on that she regretted that decision. But it doesn't matter because the consequences are there. And now it just further enshrines these ideas. And there's been a lot of talk about having the church, the Pope, rescind the doctrine of discovery. Mm-hmm. And what would that actually mean? Mm-hmm. What would that actually mean if the Pope rescinded the doctrine of discovery, if he repudiated it, if he said, you know what, actually, this was wrong.
Yeah.
This was just so wrong. And Bruce McIver, he's a legal scholar. He says that it would actually impact future land claim settlements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That it may not impact anything that's currently in existence,
right?
But there's always land claims happening, right?
As
tribes try to, because particularly out in BC, we're going to talk about treaties. Canada didn't even bother with treaties by the time they got to BC.
Yeah,
we have the Peace and Friendship Treaties out east, which never ceded territory, which was just an agreement to share and live together in peace and friendship, which is why that's what they're called. And then the other treaties, as you move westward, also not seen from our point of view as a ceding of land as mm-hmm. much as an agreement to share. Mm-hmm. And I read the book Treaty 3, mostly because when it mentioned some of my family members. And so that was why I read it.
Okay.
It's a really interesting book because it includes the actual diaries of the commissioners, including Duncan, what's his name, who started the Indian Affairs. Anyway, what they put in the treaty was not, and they admit this in their diaries, was not what they told the Indians.
Right. Okay.
And sometimes not even close.
Yeah. willful deception.
Yeah. It wasn't, you couldn't even call it a misunderstanding. It was just like not even close. Yeah. And they admit this in their diaries because they didn't think that we could understand.
Right.
But then by the time they got to BC, they just didn't bother with treaties at all. So land claims is still an ongoing thing that's happening. Yeah. And if the doctrine of discovery was repudiated, mm-hmm. then it would have impact on future land claims that are going before the courts. Mm. So that's kind of interesting to me. Mm. What I think is a lot more doable is for the big churches, particularly the Catholic Church, to give back their land.
Give back the land.
Right.
Give it back. Right. Give it back. Yeah. How hard would that be? Give it back and then lease the land that their church building sits on, lease it back from the indigenous people, just give it back. It's really not that complicated.
It's a big challenge for the Anglican Church as well. I mean, we would say, you know,
we're in it.
How we deal with this. I mean, we had the Mohawk Institute, right? Like, you know, the whole thing.
Yeah. Just give it back.
Right. The doctrine of discovery, when we think about it, we've been talking about land. Entitled, you know, Christian explorers to not only land, but there's another aspect in the sense that it entitled them to people, as long as those people, mm-hmm. you know, weren't already Christians, right? So there's this twin entitlements to land and to bodies, and that formed the basis for the nations of the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah.
And these nations are built on stolen land and displaced people. And you write in the book, Patty, these new countries pushed us aside, just as ancient glaciers had done, leaving behind pebbles of names and barren communities in a new landscape dominated by new peoples. Mm-hmm. Love that image. That was so helpful. And on that point, many of our provinces, our states, cities, rivers, they are words in native languages. Michigan, Toronto, Ottawa, Manitoba, Alabama, Connecticut. These are just a few examples. And we say these names regularly as part of our everyday vocabulary and don't really think about it, yet they are, you know, ambient sounds that fill in the silence that no one really notices. And you make the case that names are never neutral. Mm. They have something that they can teach us. Can you say more about the importance of being mindful of the names that we have around us? Because, you know, we don't even notice.
Yeah, I get reminded regularly how important stories are when we think of the name, right? Because mm-hmm. when Michigan, I think, mm-hmm. Or Chicago means, I think it means skunk. Mm. I don't know. I don't even remember a lot of these names. I don't even remember a lot of these names. But there's a story around it, right? Like it's not, you know, like we're not naming it after, you know, an important person, you know, somebody that was important to us. You know, we name it as a descriptive. It's our relationship to it. And it contains a story.
Yes.
And then that story contains history about that place. And so those are all of the things that get written on top of when we then turn around and instead of Toronto, we call it Toronto. Mm-hmm. And we lose all of that. We kind of get that sense that Canada began 200 years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of Upper and Lower Canada. And you'll hear people even talking about it that way as if there wasn't anybody here, mm-hmm. as if there wasn't anything of political importance happening.
Right. Yeah. For millennia.
There weren't languages and religions and civilizations rising and falling and all of that stuff that was also happening in Asia.
Right.
It was also happening here. Like we had our own Neolithic revolution. We had several of them where new foods emerged and kind of created societies. And so that's where these names, and you're starting to see some old names kind of being reasserted or remembered and saying, no, this is the name. This is the name of the
Right.
And so that's, I offer that as a task to people. And I'm not even modeling it very well right now because I don't remember the name, but I don't remember what Niagara stands for. I think it has something to do with rushing waters. Yeah. But to think about those names, to think about what sounds unfamiliar.
Right.
Yeah. And like, what does this mean? What is the connection?
Yeah.
What is the connection that the people who named this place had with that particular word? Because we know Amherst, like the town of Amherst.
Amherstburg,
where Trader
Joe's
is. Well, that's Amherst, just in Buffalo, then, right? It's over by Buffalo. Trader Joe's is there, so that's why that was in my brain. Because I like going to Trader Joe's.
Who doesn't love Trader Joe's?
But anyway, like, he was a terrible person.
Awful. Yeah.
And yet we named them after, like, names contain history.
Absolutely.
And, but we don't. We disconnect them from that history.
Right.
You know, we don't call it the guy who tried to kill Indians with smallpox blankets, which is who he was.
This is who he was.
But and it's okay to acknowledge that that's who he was.
Right.
And to go to your earlier point about not wanting to cut off our roots, instead of pretending that Amherst didn't do those terrible things.
Yeah,
he did. And what's present in our current medical system?
Yeah.
That operates in a very similar way.
Right.
How did COVID
so
disproportionately impact mm-hmm. Black and Indigenous communities? What things that Amherst thought are still operating in our society so that we see more death happening in these marginalized communities? And why are these communities marginalized and deliberately underfunded and deliberately over-policed?
Because if
COVID runs rampant through prisons, and it does, because how the heck are you supposed to
separate,
maintain 6 foot distance when you're in when you're in that circumstance, and you've got prisons that are 80% Indigenous out west? How is that not genocide?
Yes, well, it is genocide.
How is that not a modern genocide?
Yeah.
So
and a lack of concern to do something about it. This is where I think this whole theme of, you know, establishing kinship and you know, not having to disavow the past, but to actually say, okay, well, now we acknowledge the past, we know about it. So what do we do now? Right? Like, we don't have to continue. Thinking about that in terms of the disappearance of Indigenous peoples, whether we're talking about missing, murdered Indigenous women and girls, the 60s scoop, you know, it goes on and on. As you mentioned earlier, to reference where people have to go to school. Like, you know, sometimes there's just so much that goes on. You write that through various proclamations, treaties, and removals, we disappeared from land and into towns and Indian country, and finally into reservations. By the late 1800s, most Indigenous folks have disappeared, and it was then that the U.S. and Canadian governments began the systemic work of removing the Indian from the Indigenous child. And what we know, of course, or speak about as residential schooling. Here's a quote from the book. Every American Indian in the United States and Canada has been touched by the residential school system in one way or another. The generational trauma that resulted from decades of this policy is incalculable. There is the loss of language and stories, the loss of relationship. There is the deliberate forgetting of our personal histories to avoid the pain of not forgetting. The destruction of what was ours replaced our languages with French, English, Spanish, or our stories with the Bible, and our systems of kinship with isolated nuclear families. These losses have been woven into our existence as Native people and written into our DNA as surely as our ancestors are. I have to tell you, I excerpt that through the Kindle app and shared it out on Twitter and Facebook, and the response I received to that particular one from descendant settler people about the pain of reading that, and just how, you know, like that, you really succinctly name it in there. These programs were an attempt by the governments of the United States and Canada to change the language, change the religion. It was genocide. We'll just say it was genocide. Now, although residential school system has ended, many young people in the United States and Canada still leave their reservations to go to school. I wonder if you can talk to us about the terrible legacy of the schools themselves, the institution, as well as the 60s scoop, the current state of child welfare system, which again is disproportionately involved in Indigenous families, tearing families apart instead of addressing the root issues. And it doesn't, and you point out that it's often done with a vocabulary of words like safe and educated and civilized. You know, it's always couched in this pretty nice language. But that's all done to justify war against Indigenous communities and separate folks and their families. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, I could say that I worked in child welfare for 16 years. I was a true believer when I started, you know, because who doesn't want kids to be safe?
Right.
Right? Like, right. That sounds like a pretty swell cause.
A noble goal. We want all kids to be safe.
A noble goal. And I mean, I remember sitting in meetings at work and just being told how noble our profession was.
Yes.
And I mean, if you have to sell it that hard, you really need to have a good hard think about what it is that you're actually selling.
That's right.
But I remember sitting, I'd gone, so University of Toronto, the OISE campus, does an annual decolonizing conference. And I'd gone to one year, and Rebecca Landertinger was presenting her master's paper at the time. And she wanted to know, so the question she wanted to answer was, why are there so many Native kids in care? What's going on? And she was completely unprepared for the answer. And so she was going through like their own archives, you know, look at their own records. There's nothing Canadians and Americans like doing better than documenting this crap out of everything.
Yes, that's true.
All of this stuff in the archives. And so you've got the kids in residential, you know, they've come to residential school. You've got a former Civil War general who actually coins the phrase, you know, save the man, kill the, you know, save,
yes.
kill the Indian, save the man.
Yeah.
You know, so it's all about transforming Indians into, you know, kind of this Western European ideal of what constitutes civilized. And so right around World War II, so now we've got the horrors of the German concentration camps splashed all over the news. And you've actually got in their archives,
yeah,
people saying, holy smokes. Holy smokes. We got to get these kids out of residential schools.
Yeah.
Because it's pretty well documented that Hitler came here and thought that, you know, reserves and residential schools were
bad. Yeah.
Yeah. And we can say that. But what's also true is that the ideas that led to reservations in residential schools came from Europe in the first place, right? Because Europe has this long history of treating Jews and Muslims exactly that way.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and they had tried, you know, they have schools in Ireland and they tried reservations in Ireland, and then they came and then they brought it here. So it's not like we invented this stuff.
No.
You know, it's like Canadians just like kind of pulled it out of nowhere. But anyway, so you've actually got in their own documentation, we need, something's got to change.
Yeah.
You know, we can't be having kids in residential schools anymore because one, they're dying. This has been documented from Peter Bryce onwards.
Mm-hmm.
But also, it's going to look really bad. Yep. And that's what they're concerned about. This is what's horrifying Laura in her research, is they're upset about how it's going to make Canada look on the world stage.
Right.
So now, meanwhile, the child welfare system has been in full swing because, and Nell Irvin Painter does a really good job in the history of white people in talking about this, because she says social work emerges because despite all of the privileges and exceptionalities of being white, some people just weren't amounting to much and they had to figure out why.
Why?
What is wrong with these people? And so that's where, so that's where these standardized tests and IQ ideas about IQ and all of that comes into play. So the child welfare system had already been created to save white children from their defective parents and kind of raise them to be good empire citizens. And it's like, okay, so now let's use this system since we can't keep kids in residential schools anymore. Now let's use this system to turn native kids into good little empire citizens.
Yeah.
And Laura was just so completely horrified by this. She was not expecting this out of edge. And I remember hearing her talk because she kept emphasizing that this was in their own archives. It's like she couldn't believe they wrote this stuff down.
They were saying it out loud. Yeah.
Yeah, because they didn't see anything wrong with it.
That's right.
It seemed completely reasonable that if you want, and it is from a state point of view, if you want people to be good citizens, then you train them up while they're young. You know, train a child up in the way he should go, right? Mm-hmm. And so they sent these kids literally all over the world. A friend of mine wound up in New Zealand, through the 60s scoop. And it's all part of that. How do we create good Canadian American citizens? Well, we do it by taking them from their suspect parents.
Yeah.
And putting them with good Canadian citizens. And you still see that in the foster parent process in terms of how foster parents are trained. Because if we valued families, we would support families.
Right.
If parents got half the resources that we give to foster parents, and I don't even just mean the per diem.
No. Right?
Nobody's getting rich off that per diem. But what they're getting is they're also getting in-home parenting support.
Right.
They're getting a worker who will come with them to appointments to make sure that doctors take them seriously and without all of the stigma associated with the child welfare worker coming to your appointments. You know, they get drives to places. Anywhere that kid needs to go, they get a drive.
Yeah.
And, you know, imagine if you didn't have to take your kids to soccer practice and all of that stuff. You had somebody who would take them for you. Yeah. Like, that would be amazing. You know, they get Christmas money. They get all of these things that if we gave them to our families.
Right.
Families, you would see a decrease in domestic violence. You would see a decrease in all kinds of stuff. And we know that it's cheaper. You know, I always harp on this, that we know that housing people and providing adequate medical and mental health care is cheaper.
Cheaper.
But we don't do it.
We don't do it.
And why don't we do it? Because it serves our country to not provide people with these things, even though it's more expensive not to.
That's right. And I think the part is that it doesn't fit the narrative, which is a colonial narrative, right?
Yeah. And I think that's where this relationship and kinship is so important, just to kind of circle back to the book.
Yeah.
Off my soapbox and back to the book.
Yeah.
Because this doesn't help regular Canadians either.
No.
Right? Like,
we all suffer.
I love the story of the so-called Good Samaritan. And I got this perspective from Jessica Price, who's a Jewish writer.
Mm-hmm.
And she notes that when Jesus' audience heard this, their minds would have gone back to 2 Chronicles 28.
Mm-hmm.
When the people who were still the northern tribes were not yet called Samaritans,
mm-hmm.
helped the Jews who had been trampled by the Assyrians. And they helped them.
Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. and clothed them and mm-hmm. gave them medical care mm-hmm. and made sure they were somewhere safe. Mm-hmm. And that's what Jesus's audience would have heard in the story mm-hmm. of the Samaritan. Mm-hmm. They would have remembered, oh yeah, they did this before. They did this before. And the Samaritans and the Jews are, of course, both living under Roman occupation. And so what I love about that story is it's that call to radical memory, to that yes. unforgetting, to not thinking you're so much better than everybody else.
Yes.
To remember that we are kin, that yeah. we are related, that we are in this together. Mm-hmm. And that Galen Weston does not care about any
no.
of us.
No.
So why don't we just align and what work together?
What did I say? No shame? Someone did a shirt, no shame? No shame.
Yeah. So why don't we work together instead of just squabbling over scraps?
Yes. Right. Yeah.
You know, we should be working together.
Amen.
And another aspect to kinship is not just how we relate to each other and with each other, but our relationship to the land. And you talked a bit about that as well. And a quote again from Patty's book. I want us to consider our relationship with land, to think about it beyond squabbling over ownership and rights, and to think about responsibilities and reciprocal relationships. We've had, just as an aside, we had Randy Woodley on here a couple of times and talked to him a lot about that and that relationship. Mm-hmm. But to continue, you're right, to think of ourselves as part of creation rather than apart from it. What if the land is being in its own right? That concept is not as foreign as you might think. And what if the land and all that grows from it and on it are sentient beings in their own right? Then we need to make material changes that restore the land to our original agreements. Mm. We need to remember that the land belongs to itself and everyone belongs to the Creator. Mm. And you're right, Patty, about your own experience of reconnecting with the land when you made a trip from Niagara Falls to Sioux Lookout, right? And you share that, you know, you were surprised by what you called the undeniable sensation that the land and water remembered you. Wow. Can you share more about that experience? And you know, why is it important for us to reconnect with the land?
Yeah, so I had just reconnected with my father. He took, I don't know, like a 20 or so year hiatus. Mm-hmm. Found him kind of by accident. And we went back home. At this point, his mother, my granny, was still alive. And so we went back to see her. And yeah, it was really unexpected. Mm. Because I hadn't, you know, and in the book, I kind of describe it as electric, but that's not really correct either. I just don't really have the language to
right.
How do you describe feeling remembered by
something very numinous
as inanimate?
Yeah.
You know, how do you even begin to describe that? But I felt known.
Yeah.
And it was really unexpected because I'm not, you know, kind of like, you know, this mystical kind of person getting that way. But at the time I really wasn't. Also, I mean, I'm raised evangelical, right? So the right, idea yeah, that the land right. could speak to me, that's just yeah. like, pagan yeah, scary
yeah,
things.
Yeah, pagan.
So yeah, so it was unexpected on a whole lot of fronts. But yeah, if the land is alive in that way,
yeah.
and really the Hebrew Bible, you know, like the Old Testament talks mm-hmm. about the language, talks about the land in that way. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Right? You know, trees are clapping and not, mm-hmm. I don't think the mm-hmm. prophet thought that they were actually smacking their branches together, yeah. but that they were expressing joy
right.
Mm-hmm. and talking about grief and covering itself in dust, which made me think of the Dust Bowl and John Steinbeck. And then I just read Sonora Babb's account of the same time period. Also, Erasing Indigenous People, but a good book. You know, that the land itself feels grief
yeah.
and feels joy and has its own relationship with Creator, which was, you know, Kevin, you talked about earlier, the Leviticus 25 entry into the promised land didn't belong to the Hebrews. It belonged to God.
Yeah.
And the people, so they got, when they got their allotments every 50 years, that year of Jubilee, it reverts back to the original people as a reminder that it all belongs to God. It's mm-hmm. not really yours. And what if we modeled ourselves on that and understood that these trees were just chopping down to make room for condos
yeah.
are actually alive mm-hmm. and have their own relationship with a creator we don't understand. And now we're interfering with that relationship. Yeah. And sometimes, I mean, we heat with wood fire, you know, I eat meat, you know, I pick vegetables, you know, like all of these things, but it shifts. You're a lot more
value. There's a different value.
You're not more, it's even to the point where when I'm tidying up, and like I say, I'm not like the most mystical person ever, but I'll go to throw something in the garbage and the thought will cross my mind, this is compostable. I cannot treat my relatives like garbage.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And it goes in the compost pile.
Mm, right.
Mm, you know, like where that thought crosses my mind. This is a relative. I cannot treat my relatives with disrespect. Yeah. And so and then I quote Louise Erdrich at some point in that passage that you referenced where she says, like, I'm half German. Like, do I really believe this? Like, I'm rational.
Yeah.
But what if we just lived that way? Like my kid always says, like, what if we just lived like the stuff, Matt? You know, what if we just lived like this and, you know, we just created a better world? It didn't have this kind of big cosmic meaning.
Yeah.
What if it was just a better world? Like, wouldn't that be okay too?
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, I was really taken by your writing about that because, you know, your Ukrainian background on your mother's side. And you hadn't made that trip north, and then you get up there, and it's this sort of somatic experience, right? Like, I mean, you really felt it.
I have heard similar things from people, other people who have gone home,
right?
To like wherever home is, where they felt known,
right?
They felt like, okay, this is home. This is home. They felt known. I don't know if I went back to the Ukraine, if Ukraine would know me.
Right.
Maybe it would. I don't know.
Maybe.
The water's
maybe that's
from
the
here.
Part we
go across the ocean and into the Mediterranean and Baltic Sea. So I don't know. Yeah. Maybe it would know me. I don't know. I'd like to go one day.
So much in this book that you know we could talk about, but we're an hour in. So I'll give you one more, but I will say this again. If I haven't already said it a dozen times, get the book and read it because you're going to love this book, Becoming Kin. You write a quote from the book, again, about your maternal family being Ukrainian. My mother made a choice to raise me among settlers and apart from my Ojibwe relatives. Her decision wasn't malicious, but the harm was real. And I have to sit with that. You go on to say, I can't pretend it didn't happen or that it didn't insulate me from some things, even as it failed to insulate me from others. Because of the way that others saw me as the brown child in a white family, I had identity without relationships. I got to say, when I read that, I was like, poof. The combination, identity with no community, impoverished me, you write. That impoverishment was a constant hum in the background of my life. My face told a story that the rest of me couldn't articulate except as loss and as absence. Now, my heart, I just thought, wow. And you write in that chapter about race shifting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I coming from Newfoundland, keep up on the news there. And the current president of Memorial University is in the middle of a big brouhaha because of her claiming indigeneity when that's not the life that she's lived. I mean, she's acknowledged that at different points, but it's all very sordid and strange. As she's claimed Mi'kmaq ancestry, there seems to be more of this race shifting. We hear big stories about it in the news. When you write about being good relatives, you say that being good relatives doesn't mean that you are distant cousins who somehow need to claim indigeneity. Being good relatives means claiming your own ancestry, all of them, all of your ancestors. And when you know who you are and when you are comfortable with who you are, you can enter into relationship with us rather than as us. I wonder if you can say more about that, because I think that passage, that little piece that I read about your own experience, you know, that business of your face telling a story that the rest of you couldn't articulate except in loss and in absence is really quite profound. Say more about the importance of this business of owning our own ancestors.
Yeah, because, I mean, and some of it is because we think of Indigenous as a race, right? We think of it as a race, like,
social,
you know, like
construct.
And it's not. It's a political it's a political, like, you know, Ojibwe, we are a political entity, right? Yes, and that we have a shared language and a shared religion and, you know, a belief system and a shared way of living. And I had relatives that I didn't know, relatives that I had been kept from. I had a friendship center that was in town that my mom had been told was full of drug users and that I shouldn't go there. And so I didn't even know they existed.
Wow.
So she's trying to keep me safe, right? She's you know, trying to raise this child and trying to keep me safe. Except that I am brown skinned, right? Like, I'm not dark brown, but like, I have a pretty good tan for March.
Well, especially on this screen. Especially on this screen.
Yeah, this screen.
Because they don't get pastier than us do.
So I'm growing up and getting asked, like, where are you from? Where are you from? Where are you from? Because growing up in Niagara, I don't look like I'm from Niagara, right? So where are you from? Where are you from? And how do you answer that?
Right.
As an Indigenous child with no relatives to explain where I'm from.
Right.
You know, and so that's that loss. And so I didn't know how. And so I like would say dumb things like, you know, I'm more Canadian than you are. Yeah, okay. Or they would say, what part Indian are you? And I'd say, oh, you know, my head and my heart. Like, because I didn't know, right? Like, I grew up on Little House on the Prairie and Bonanza. Mm-hmm. So I knew about as much about being Indigenous as you know, most settlers knew. So when people, you know, and so I'm talking about father, cousins, possible siblings that might be out there that I, you know, that I don't know. Like I'm talking about actual relatives that I could know, but I don't know, you know, and this is the same thing that, you know, people who are scooped experience, right? Yep. You know, they've got parents and, you know, and relatives, siblings that may be placed literally all over several, you know, scattered across several countries. You know, so there's tangible relatives. So when somebody comes along and says, wow, I've found, you know,
Ancestry.com says
I found, I found an Algonquin woman from the from the early 1800s in my family tree. So, wow, I'm Métis. Why not? Because that person married white, maybe to feel safe, maybe because that was the only option available to her. And then their kids married white, again, to feel safe, to assimilate into Canadian society and not have to deal with everything. Well, you do that for five or six generations, and you're Canadian.
Yeah.
You're white. You're, you've got an Algonquin ancestor, but you don't have any Algonquin relatives.
Right.
You don't have a connection to an Algonquin community.
Right.
And you can still be a good relative. You can honor that Algonquin woman by joining in and making sure that other kids don't get displaced. You can honor, like I tell the story of somebody, and this is like we're at work, right? And we're waiting for this doctor to come in and tell us stuff about some child we had brought into the hospital. And she says to me, you know, we always heard that my grandpa was Native, or great-grandpa, and you know, we thought he was maybe Mohawk. And I'm sitting there, I'm like, oh my God, here we go. And it's a work person in my head. And then she says, you know, so I try to honor him by, you know, by supporting Indigenous issues and by really trying to educate myself. And I swear I wanted to jump across the room and give her a because, yeah, I have an Irish grandpa, like great-grandpa, Irish great-grandpa, Isaiah McCauley, and he is very well documented on Ancestry.com. So his aunt, I found him all the way back to the 1600s. I'm not Irish.
No.
I went to Ireland. I did not try to be Irish.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it. My kid loves Irish music.
Yeah.
But he is also not trying to be Irish. He just lives in Halifax. So like that's all they do in Halifax.
Yeah.
You know, we don't, but we can honor Isaiah. We can honor him by educating ourselves on issues around Ireland and taking whatever solidarity actions are possible for us to take. You know, he did do social justice work when he lived in Ireland for a couple of years. So there's ways of honoring our ancestors and honoring our connectedness without needing to invent this relationship with the Canadian state that you don't have.
Right. In fact, that
because
becomes...
that's what indigeneity is, right? It's a relationship to the colonial state.
Yeah.
And if you have been in alliance with the colonial state for five generations, then that's who you are. And you have your own responsibilities and your own points of access that Indigenous people don't have.
And so, in fact,
but
I was going to say the pretense and that is involved with race shifting is a dishonor to that great grandmother, right?
Yes.
You know, like, I mean, to your point, she may have married that way for a whole bunch of pressures that were on the move. And if the race shifting to say, oh, well, now I'm Cree or I'm Ojibwe or whatever, because of this great, great, great grandmother, and you've had no connection over all those years, you know, it's a dishonoring at the pretense in my mind, because what you're doing, you're like, God knows what she went through. And you're just simply going to assume an identity, which she probably suffered greatly for, like, you know, and had to make difficult choices.
And what about all your other ancestors? Like, I talk about this too. Yes. What, but I'm supposed to sit and tell my German grandma that she doesn't matter? Lula matters?
Right.
That the contribution that Anne made to my life?
Yeah.
And that her mother, Anna? Like, there's some really good stories of resilience and creativity and resistance to empire. And I mean, there's some collusion with empire. You know, they were not well liked by the Bolsheviks the time of the heat of the revolution. Yeah. So, you know, they were factory owners and everything that came with that. Yeah. But, you know, there's some good stuff back there that also informs how I live and move in this world and how disrespectful to those ancestors to pretend that Lula is the only one that matters.
That's right.
Like, that's just rude.
Well, like Kevin said, Patty, we could go on and on. There's so much more in the book to talk about, but our time is up. That's why we're recommending people to pick up the book and read it and find out more. All right. Becoming Kin and an Indigenous Call to Unforgetting the Past and Reimagining the Future. And Patty, thank you for joining us, giving us the time, and honoring us with your presence on the Vicar's Crossing. Yeah. We appreciate it.
And Megwich.
Well, thank you so much for having me. This was fun.
All right. Thanks, Patty. And looking forward to chatting more down the road, we hope. Stay tuned to the Vicar's Crossing for perhaps more of Patty coming to a city near you.
Yes, we got to get her up here.
Forward to that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks to our sponsors again of the Vicar's Crossing. We want to show our appreciation first to A. Miller George Funeral Home, where each life is celebrated, and their sister company, Cremation London Middlesex, both family-owned and operated. To the Diocese of Huron, a community where families and individuals from Windsor to Owen Sound, Grand Bend to Port Rowan come together to worship and to serve. And to Molly Maid, you can make your home a healthy haven by calling Molly Maid London today. I'm Rob Henderson from Holy Trinity St. Stephen's in London, and that's my good buddy,
I'm Kevin, and I'm at St. Aidan's Church in London.
And Ian will be back, we hope, soon. Hope you're feeling better, my friend. And thanks to everybody for joining us on the Vicar's Crossing.
We're going to send some we're going to send some vegetables over to him, Rob.
Yeah, that's scurvy. Just get you, doesn't it? Yeah. Eat some peas, man.
Yeah, yeah.
Get some vegetables. Kevin.
Yeah.
Remember.
What?
Look both ways.
Oh, before you cross the street.
Thank you for listening. Our hosts are Kevin George and Rob Henderson. Our producer and composer is myself, Ian, with original artwork done by Elizabeth Dodman. If you have any questions or want to know where to find us, tweet us at Vicar's Crossing or find us on Facebook at The Vicar's Crossing. If you have any other questions about anything heard on this podcast, leave us a comment or look in the description to find out more. Thanks!